Hello, listeners. Welcome to Iris, and welcome to the reading of the Waterloo Cedar Falls Courier. It's Wednesday, September 21st. I'm your volunteer reader, Bob Young. Our weather forecast comes from KCRG in Cedar Rapids. A cold front continues to make steady progress through the area. We are watching some showers well off to our northwest this morning, and we could find ourselves dealing with a few of these this afternoon into the early evening. If you get underneath a shower, it'll barely measure up and should be brief. The bigger weather story is a return to a seasonable air mass today, as temperatures drop to the 60s and 70s. Tonight, lows should drop into the 40s, making for a great sleeping night. The next system will bring us a few more showers later Friday into Friday night, as highs barely make 60 degrees. The stories on the front page of the Courier today include Waterloo gets $2 million for broadband, Attorney General unveils new help for opioid addiction, Council amends ethics code, and we begin reading Arbiter meets with Trump team. This story comes from Eric Tucker and Michael Sizek of the Associated Press. Dateline Washington. The independent arbiter tasked with inspecting documents seized in an FBI search of former President Donald Trump's Florida home said Tuesday he intends to push briskly through the review process and appeared skeptical of the Trump team's reluctance to say whether it believed the records were declassified. Quote, "We're going to proceed with what I call reasonable dispatch," Raymond Deary, a veteran Brooklyn judge, told lawyers for Trump and the Justice Department in their first meeting since his appointment last week as a so-called special master. The purpose of the meeting was to sort out next steps in a review process expected to slow by weeks, if not months, the criminal investigation into the retention of top-secret information at Mar-a-Lago after Trump left the White House. As special master, Deary will be responsible for sifting through the thousands of documents recovered during the August 8th FBI search and segregating those protected by claims of executive privilege or attorney-client privilege. Though Trump's lawyers requested the appointment of a special master to ensure an independent review of the documents, one of the former president's attorneys, James Trusty, made clear they were concerned that Deary's proposed deadlines were too ambitious. The lawyers also resisted Deary's request for information about whether the seized records were declassified, as Trump maintains. In a letter to Deary on Monday night, the lawyers said the issue could be part of Trump's defense in the event of an indictment. Deary appeared unsatisfied with that position. He said, "If Trump's lawyers will not actually assert that the records were declassified, and the Justice Department instead makes an acceptable case that they remain classified, then, quote, as far as I'm concerned, that's the end of it," unquote. Trusty said, "Trump's team should not be forced at this point to disclose a possible defense based on the idea that the records had been declassified." He denied that the lawyers were trying to engage in gamesmanship-like behavior, but instead believed it was a process that required baby steps. But Deary at one point observed, quote, "I guess my view of it is you can't have your cake and eat it too," unquote. Trump has maintained without evidence that all of the records were declassified. His lawyers have not echoed that claim, though they repeatedly asserted that a president has absolute authority to declassify information. They said in a separate filing Tuesday that the Justice Department had not proven that the records remained classified. The resistance to the judge's request was notable because it was Trump's lawyers, not the Justice Department, who requested the appointment of a special master, and because the recalcitrants included an acknowledgment that the probe could be building toward an indictment. In the letter, Trump's lawyers said the time for addressing that question would be if they pressed forward with demands for the Justice Department to return some of the property taken from Mar-a-Lago. Quote, "Otherwise, the special master process will have forced the plaintiff to fully and specifically disclose a defense to the merits of any subsequent indictment, they wrote. The Trump team also asked the judge to consider pushing back all of the deadlines for his review. That work includes inspecting the roughly 11,000 documents, including about 100 marked as classified, that were taken during the FBI search. U.S. District Judge Eileen Cannon, a Trump appointee who granted the Trump team's request for a special master, had set a November 30th deadline for Deary's review and instructed him to prioritize his inspection of classified records. The Justice Department asked a federal appeals court to halt Cannon's order, requiring it to provide him with classified documents for his review. That appeal is pending. Deary, who is a Ronald Reagan appointee, whose name is on the atrium of his Brooklyn courthouse, made clear during Tuesday's meeting that he intended to meet the deadlines, saying there was little time to complete the assigned tasks. Julie Eidelstein, a Justice Department lawyer, said she was hopeful that the department could get the documents digitized and provided to Trump's lawyers by early next week. Earlier Tuesday, the Trump legal team urged the U.S. Court of Appeals for the 11th Circuit to leave in place Cannon's order temporarily, barring the Justice Department's use of the classified records for its criminal investigation while Deary completes his review. The department said that order impeded its investigation into the presence of top-secret information at Mar-a-Lago. Trump's lawyers called those concerns overblown, saying investigators could still do their work on the probe even without scrutinizing the seized records. The next story was written by Maria Cooper. Nearly $2 million awarded for Waterloo's broadband project, Dateline Waterloo. More money is coming to Waterloo for its plan to build a municipal broadband network. The U.S. Department of Commerce announced on Tuesday that the city was awarded a $1.8 million grant funded by the American Rescue Plan. Quote, "This further validates our vision for a fiber-connected, smarter Waterloo, and we welcome these dollars to fund key portions of our project," Mayor Quentin Hart said in a news release. Last week, the city got overwhelming voter approval to issue $20 million in general obligation bonds to help build the network. It passed with 84% in favor. The project has an estimated total cost of $115 million for building the fiber backbone and connecting houses to the system. Quote, "Every Waterloo citizen and visitor also deserves the highest quality, fastest internet service available, and with Waterloo fiber, this will be delivered by a highly reliable underground system, 100% fiber-based, locally owned and operated," Hart added. The investment will be matched with $667,682 in local funds and is expected to create 177 jobs. Assistant Secretary of Commerce for Economic Development Alejandra Castillo said, quote, "This investment will increase internet connectivity for businesses and residents in Waterloo, promoting business development while improving the availability of telehealth services, distance learning, and public safety," Castillo said in the news release. "This particular grant is to construct a middle-mile fiber network. The middle mile is the intersection of the fiber infrastructure, which enables internet connectivity for homes, businesses, and facilities." The city is making efforts to find other funds for the project as well. On Monday, the City Council approved a resolution with Magellan Advisors to prepare and submit another Department of Commerce grant. Maria Cooper also wrote this next story. Waterloo Council addresses complaint and censure procedures in updated ethics code. Dateline Waterloo. After 6 years of work, the City Council has amended its code of ethics. The changes were approved unanimously Monday. The council suspended its rules to approve the ordinance a second and third time, putting it into effect immediately. Quote, "I'm glad we're dealing with the code of ethics because this has been going on for years," Councillor Dave Bozen said. Most of the modifications involve complaints and censures. There are a few changes regarding the public's role in meetings. Residents can no longer request that items on the consent agenda be removed and considered separately. The new code states the public instead should contact council members with questions. One resident, David Dreyer, objected to this change. He said when he asks members questions, he rarely receives a response. The councilors and mayor said they would work on their response rates. Citizens may now only speak for a maximum of 3 minutes instead of five. However, the public is not required to pre-register to speak during public comments. Ethics violations reports will be more extensive under the changes. For elected officials, a city councilor or mayor should write a complaint that includes specific allegations with evidence supporting that a code was violated. It would also need to have specific references to code sections or city policy. The complaint must include specific dates the alleged violations occurred. Complaints must now be filed within 3 months of discovering an alleged violation. This comes after the council decided the time frame should be shortened from 6 months. The code states complaints filed after the time limitation will be rejected. After the complaint is made, the mayor or mayor pro tem will forward the complaint to the proper authorities, such as the police chief, human resources director, or city attorney, for example. 30 days after a complaint is filed, the mayor or mayor pro tem will write a report that states if a censure is warranted. If so, a resolution recommending censure will be placed on the council agenda within 2 weeks of the date of the report. If a censure is not needed, there will not be any disciplinary action. For non-elected city officials, any employee can file a written complaint against the individual. A new addition regarding retroactive censure was implemented as well. Complaints about the conduct of a former elected official while they were in office can be brought to a current elected official. The complaints against the former official will then be filed and investigated. If the complaint results in a censure, the accused former elected official can give their side of the story before a vote is taken. The public censure process was first proposed in 2019, dividing the council at the time. Ultimately, it was approved, becoming part of city code in December 2020. Waterloo is the only city in Iowa to have a censure policy. Last year, the council censured Margaret Klein after a complaint by Pat Morrissey that she had 9 violations of city code. The city attorney found she violated 5. The violations dated back to 2018. Klein, who ran unsuccessfully for mayor, is no longer on the council. Now to describe the big picture on the front page, it shows two workers assembling a tornado ride at the National Cattle Congress, which will be in Waterloo this week. Next, we have a story filed by Caleb McCullough of the Courier's Des Moines Bureau. Attorney General unveils new help for opioid addiction. State launches site opioidhelp.iowa.gov. Dateline Des Moines. Iowans struggling with opioid use disorder have a new tool to find treatment. Iowa Attorney General Tom Miller announced this week. The state of Iowa launched opioidhelp.iowa.gov, a dashboard that allows Iowans to find locations for treatment that have contracted with the state. The locations listed offer, quote, last resort treatment, which means people whose fees are not covered by insurance or Medicaid can get reduced or free treatment. Quote, if the person who is ill and treatable with this doesn't have coverage, then the programming covers the cost of treatment, Miller said. The website includes a map of Iowa broken into 19 areas with at least one treatment provider available in each area. Each of the providers offers both abstinence and medication-assisted treatment. Medication-assisted treatment involves the use of medications like methadone that reduce cravings and withdrawal symptoms without providing the high of short-acting opioids. Quote, people can use this for extended periods of time and live ordinary lives, Miller said. The providers listed on the site have been involved in treatment for a long time, Miller said. But the reason for creating the site now is to reduce stigma and provide people with more information in a convenient location. Medication-assisted treatment is not being taken advantage of to the degree that it could be in Iowa, Miller said, in part because of the stigma surrounding drug addiction. He said the website was designed to frame addiction as a treatable disease rather than a fact of life or a series of bad decisions. Quote, one of the things we're trying to do is remove the stigma so people feel more comfortable doing this and the public is more supportive of it, he said. Miller has joined multiple lawsuits alleging drug manufacturers deceptively marketed opioids and aided the opioid addiction crisis. Several companies have settled in these cases, and Miller said he's expecting Iowa will receive $225 million from those settlements over several years. We now have an opportunity to make a difference and do some things that are right, he said. And this is one of the first steps, what we think is an extraordinary website, unquote. Miller said he wants to see Iowa use the money it receives from the opioid settlement on both prevention and treatment of opioid misuse. He also said he wants to ensure these funds are distributed evenly across the state and rural areas aren't left out. Some of that settlement money has gone to University of Iowa Hospitals and Clinics, which last year launched a partnership with Miller's office on a program that helped train healthcare providers to use medication-assisted treatment using $3.8 million in settlement funds. In a video accompanying the website, UIHC addiction physicians discussed the benefits of the opioid use disorder treatment and the accompanying stigma that comes with seeking treatment. Quote, I think there's several reasons why we have this misconception that it's not treatable, clinical psychiatry professor Allison Lynch says in the video. Quote, one is because of stigma, and because if we say that people develop an addiction because they're a bad person, if they made bad choices, then we're not thinking about it as a treatable condition, unquote. Now, this story is from the Associated Press. Congress eyes strongest yet response to January 6th attack. Dateline Washington. House Democrats are voting this week on changes to a 19th century law for certifying presidential elections, their strongest legislative response yet to the January 6th Capitol insurrection and former President Donald Trump's efforts to overturn his 2020 election defeat. The vote to overhaul the Electoral Count Act, expected Wednesday, comes as a bipartisan group of senators is moving forward with a similar bill. Lawmakers in both parties have said they want to change the arcane law before it is challenged again. Trump and his allies tried to exploit the law's vague language in the weeks after the election as they strategized how they could keep Joe Biden out of office, including by lobbying Vice President Mike Pence to simply object to the certification of Biden's victory when Congress counted the votes on January 6th. Pence refused to do so, but it was clear afterward that there was no real legal framework or recourse to respond under the 1887 law if the vice president had tried to block the count. The House and Senate bills would better define the vice president's ministerial role and make clear that he or she has no say in the final outcome. Both versions would also make it harder for lawmakers to object if they don't like the results of the election, clarify laws that would allow a state's vote to be delayed, and ensure that there is only one slate of legal electors from each state. One strategy by Trump and his allies was to create alternate slates of electors in states Biden won, with the ultimately unsuccessful idea that they could be voted on during the congressional certification on January 6th and result in throwing the election back to Trump. Now let's turn the page to the Cedar Valley section. 9 Iowa Walgreens pharmacies, including one in Waterloo, hit with fines and licensing sanctions. Story filed by Clark Kaufman of the Iowa Capital Dispatch. State licensing officials have sanctioned pharmacies in 9 of Iowa's Walgreens stores for a variety of alleged violations, including missing narcotics, a lack of qualified personnel, and issues that caused some Iowans to lose access to their medications. Some of the stores that the Iowa Board of Pharmacy imposed sanctions against at its August meeting mostly faced an identical set of charges and $10,000 of penalties. Among those is the Walgreens at 111 West Ridgeway Avenue in Waterloo, along with others in Clive, Ankeny, and Des Moines. The Waterloo Walgreens store and 5 of the others were each charged with failing to maintain accountability of controlled substances and records, and with failing to create and maintain complete and accurate records of all controlled substances on hand. According to the board, each of them reported losses of controlled substances to the board in November 2020, which Walgreens attributed to employee theft. The available documents made public by the board do not disclose the full scope of the theft. The board later asked Walgreen Company to perform an audit of all controlled substances at the 6 stores from June 2019 through June 2021. The audit reports for each of the pharmacies showed, quote, a large number of drug products which were found to have losses or overages, the board alleged, and Walgreen Company was unavailable to definitely determine what led to the loss of so many controlled substances. According to the board, the audit indicated that many of the inventory quantities that showed zero controlled substances on hand, quote, must have been inaccurately entered at the time of the annual inventory, although it's not clear from the board records what that means with regard to actual losses versus inaccurately reported losses. In September 2021, the store was inspected. At that time, the store's on-hand count of hydrocodone was short 247 tablets, after which a board compliance officer requested a full audit of all Schedule II controlled substances. That audit identified a shortage of 44 tablets of oxycodone and a shortage of 60 capsules of dexmethylphenidate. The license of each of the 6 pharmacies, as well as the license of the Des Moines store on Southeast 14th Street, have been placed on probation for 1 year, and each store has been fined $20,000, although only $10,000 of that needs to be paid, pending on compliance with other board requirements, with the remaining $10,000 in penalties considered stayed. In addition, all permanent pharmacists and technicians employed by the 7 stores must complete 2 more hours of education on inventory management and commit to implementing a new inventory management system by the end of October. Also, any discrepancies between the actual and expected counts of controlled substances shall result in a $500 civil penalty, and delays in implementing the inventory control system shall result in $1,500 penalties, with both to be drawn from the $10,000 in stayed penalties. The 2 other stores sanctioned by the board for different reasons are in Mason City and Des Moines. The store denied the allegations, but agreed to a settlement that entails a $4,500 civil penalty. The next article was written by Andy Malone. Cedar Falls Council votes 4-3 against applying for a $9.76 million grant to remove railroad tracks. Dateline Cedar Falls. The City Council, in a split vote Monday, turned down an opportunity to apply for federal funds to help remove an unused railroad spur. If awarded, the city would have received $9.76 million. But the council's 4-3 vote against seeking the funds hinged on what the city would be required to pay. $1.22 million, or half the match for the project's estimated $12.2 million cost. The railroad company would have paid the other half of the match. Representatives of the Iowa Northern Railway Company and Cedar Falls Utility spoke to the benefits of the city applying for the money to deal with removing unused railroad tracks that cut through residential areas and downtown. Grant funds would come from the Federal Railroad Administration's new Railroad Crossing Elimination Program, created by the bipartisan infrastructure bill. Quote, the tracks have sat fairly idle for the last 15 years, and it's not like we have this immense need to remove them, said Councillor Gil Schultz after the meeting. He was joined in his opposition to the application's submission by Councillors Dave Sires, Susan DeBurr, and Dustin Ganfield. Quote, there's not a huge safety issue with really no trains on them, Schultz noted, and it's more than $1 million expense that just popped up and we didn't budget for, unquote. Additionally, there was concern CFU might need to use the tracks despite the municipal utility having not utilized them for coal delivery since 2010. General Manager Steve Bernard projected it would be another 10 or 20 years before CFU brings in more coal. Quote, I truly believe we need to keep the track intact in case CFU needs it, Sires told the Courier. CFU is a gem for this city and what they provide in terms of electricity and internet. DeBurr said she didn't have enough information to justify spending $1.2 million. Ganfield also wanted more time to hash out the details in committee, but was concerned about the dollar figure and losing the potential for coal delivery via the railroad. Bernard said the days of using massive amounts of coal are probably behind us, and supported the project for reasons such as it making the streets safer and more aesthetically pleasing. CFU has a stockpile of coal and could lean on truck delivery or out-of-area rail lines to obtain the commodity, he said. Quote, coal is really important for us as a backup fuel, Bernard added. We used it extensively in February 2021 when we had the extremely cold stretch. Natural gas was really, really scarce at that point and extremely expensive. Approximately 11,642 linear feet of track, or a little more than 2 miles, runs near the intersection of Iowa and West First Streets next to McDonald's, through downtown and several hundred feet past Cedar Falls Utilities, to an area near Pfeiffer Springs Park off Grand Boulevard. Now that's been denied, the company could try finding a customer to locate along the line that's only used for railroad car storage at this time. But that seems unlikely since its rail yard is located in a floodplain, Iowa Northern Railway General Manager William McGee told the council. Quote, Iowa Northern is a good citizen. We've always stuck by CFU, McGee said. We've always been here. The problem we've got is what else the line can be used for to generate any revenue for the railroad, unquote. After the meeting, he said abandoning the tracks has been a consideration for 20 years, and the company may try to gain the council's blessing for an application again next year. The train tracks have been rehabilitated over the years, but have followed the same path since 1871, McGee said. One positive touted about the endeavor was making the streets where the line runs more safe. The track itself can pose a threat to pedestrians and cyclists, as can the standing rail cars that sometimes attract people who climb on them. Another benefit was that the federal funding could have been used to cover a bulk of the city's future street reconstruction costs in the area. Quote, what we are projecting within this grant is total reconstruction of many of those streets, Iowa Street, Fifth Street, and it would be about $1.3 million, and that would just be a fraction of what that would cost for reconstruction of those corridors, said City Administrator Ron Gaines. Additionally, possible future improvements, like a new trail connection, could have happened because of the tracks removal with the help of the funds. Quote, I feel it's important to foster relationships and work with both CFU and the railroad company on this project, said Councillor Simon Harding, who voted in favor of submitting the application. Quote, they have a deep understanding of what will work for each entity, and I trust their input. Quote, on top of everything, it's a large federal grant in this situation and is a win-win for everyone, he added. And listeners, we would now like to remind you that you're hearing the reading of the Waterloo Cedar Falls Courier for Wednesday, September 21st on IRIS, the Iowa Radio Reading Information Service for the Blind. Now let's turn to today's obituaries. Grundy Center, LaRue Brandemuehl, 89, of rural Grundy Center, Iowa, passed away on September 15, 2022, at Westbrook Acres. A graveside service will be held Monday, September 26, 2022, at 11 o'clock a.m. at Oakland Cemetery in Beeman, Iowa. Friends and family are welcome to join the family at Beeman Memorial Hall following the graveside service for food and fellowship. Memorials may be made to Salem Church or Cedar Valley Hospice. Online condolences may be made by visiting www.ablesfuneralhomes.com. LaRue was born on October 22, 1932, the youngest daughter of Dave and Pauline Paustian Rage. She graduated from Gladbrook High School, Marshalltown School of Nursing as an RN, the University of Minnesota in Nursing Administration, and Buena Vista University with a degree in business. As a lifelong member of the Salem Church of Lincoln, she participated in various organizations. She was a member of numerous professional organizations and received various professional awards. She was employed as a nursing administrator at Grundy County Memorial Hospital and as a program coordinator for the Iowa Department of Inspections and Appeals, Des Moines. LaRue enjoyed traveling with friends and family to various countries. She authored several books for her family. She married Dean Warren in 1950, and they had four children, Rodney, Wendy, Dean Jr., and Brett. Dean preceded her in death in 1975. She married Glenn Oetker in 1979, and he preceded her in death in 1981. She married David Brandemuehl in 2004, and he preceded her in death in 2006. She is survived by her children and many nieces and nephews. Grundy Center, Marlis Faye Rops, 88, of Grundy Center, Iowa, passed away on September 15, 2022. A visitation will be held Friday, September 23, 2022, from 4 o'clock p.m. to 7 o'clock p.m. at Abel's Funeral and Cremation Service, Anglicus Chapel in Grundy Center. A private family interment will follow at a later date at Allison Cemetery. Memorials may be made to the family. Online condolences may be made by visiting www.ablesfuneralhomes.com. Marlis was born May 28, 1934, in rural Grundy County, Iowa, to Marie and Reinhard Kalkwerf. She graduated from Dyke High School in 1952. She was united in marriage to John Menno Ropes on March 10, 1954, at Christian Reformed Church in Parkersburg, Iowa. The two owned and operated a farm near Allison for many years, then owned and operated Lee's Lanes in Mason City, Iowa, for 13 years before retiring. Marlis enjoyed bowling, gardening, puzzles, and spending time with her dog, Augie. She also enjoyed the occasional visit to casinos and traveling to Arizona in the winter. More than anything, Marlis enjoyed spending time with her family. Waterloo. Elmore E. Harold, 99, of Waterloo, died Friday, September 16th at his home. He was born October 7th, 1922, in Cresco, son of Carl and Rose Harold. He married Lucille Holman on November 26, 1946, at St. Joseph Catholic Church in Cresco. She died on June 11, 2016. Elmore was employed at Rath Packing Company for 42 years, retiring as a supervisor in 1984. He was a veteran of World War II, serving in the U.S. Army from 1943 to 1945. He received the Purple Heart. Elmore enjoyed volunteering at the St. Vincent de Paul Welfare Office and the Black Hawk Veterans Affairs, taking veterans to their doctor's appointments. He also enjoyed fishing. Services for Elmore will be 10 o'clock a.m. Saturday, September 24th, at Sacred Heart Catholic Church in Waterloo. He will be escorted by the Patriot Guard Riders to Calvary Cemetery, Cresco, for burial, where full military rites will be conducted by the Cresco Veterans Organizations and the Iowa Army Honor Guard. Public visitation will be for 1 hour before services at the church on Saturday. Haggerty Wyckoff Grarup Funeral Service on West Ridgeway is in charge of arrangements. In lieu of flowers, memorials may be directed to Sacred Heart Catholic Church, Black Hawk County Veteran Affairs, or Cedar Valley Hospice. Online condolences may be left at www.haggertywyckoffgrarup.com. Winthrop, Norris C. Kimball, 82, of Winthrop, Iowa, died on September 18, 2022, at ABCM West Campus, Independence. Services will be at a later date. Final resting place will be Fremont Cemetery, Winthrop, Iowa. Fawcett Smith's Funeral Home, Winthrop, is assisting the family. Online obituary is at www.jamesonsmithsfuneralhome.com. Norris worked at John Deere in Waterloo from 1958 until 1997. He was a member of the UAW Union 838. Cedar Falls, Harlan Henry Wilson, 76, of Cedar Falls, died Sunday, September 18, 2022, at Western Home Communities, The Suites. He was born on February 19, 1946, in Waterloo, Iowa, the son of Carl and Melda Maldzahn Wilson. He graduated from Jessup High School in 1964. On May 18, 1968, he was united in marriage to Rose Christian. After his enlistment in the Army, Harlan worked as the assistant manager of Hy-Vee in Cedar Falls. He then worked for the city of Cedar Falls before working for Municipal Pipe and Tool. He was a member of the Cedar Falls City Council and even ran for mayor. He also had his realty, auctioneer, and barber licenses. Mass of Christian burial will be at 10 o'clock a.m. Saturday, September 24th, 2022, at St. Patrick Catholic Church in Cedar Falls. Visitation will be from 4 o'clock to 7 o'clock p.m. Friday at Richardson Funeral Service in Cedar Falls. Interment will be at Westview Cemetery in LaPorte City. Memorials may be directed to the family to be determined at a later date. Online condolences may be left at www.richardsonfuneralservice.com. And here the courier lists two death notices. Robert P., known as Bob Cronin, 85, of Waterloo, died Monday, September 19, 2022, at his home. Arrangements are with Locke Funeral Services in Waterloo. And Vivian Lorraine, known as Laurie Williams, 89, of Cedar Falls, died Saturday, September 17, 2022, at Unity Point Health Allen Hospital in Waterloo. Arrangements for Vivian are with Van Hoof Schoof Funeral Home and Cremation Service in Cedar Falls. Waterloo. Lloyd Schaefer, 85, of Waterloo, died Saturday, September 17, 2022, at the Cedar Valley Hospice Home. He was born June 18, 1937, in Moline, Illinois, to Joseph M. and Laverne G. Alderman Schaefer. He graduated from Waterloo West High School and then served in the United States Army. Lloyd married Barbara Ann Philbrant on September 30, 1956, in Waterloo. She preceded him in death on May 27, 2022. Lloyd worked for John Deere in the Computer Systems Department, retiring on January 31, 1999. He enjoyed riding his motorcycle and had traveled by motorcycle through all 50 states, Mexico, Canada, and Europe. He also had many friends, including a breakfast club that met weekly. Services for Lloyd will be Saturday, October 1st, 2022, at 11 a.m. at Lock at Tower Park, 4140 Kimball Avenue, with visitation 1 hour prior at the funeral home. Memorials may be directed to the family. Johnston, Patricia C. Entz, 94, of Johnston, formerly of Waterloo, died Sunday, September 18, 2022, at Bishop Drum in Johnston. She was born March 14, 1928, in Waterloo, daughter of Daniel D. and Bernice Hawk Hogan. She graduated from Jessup High School in 1945. Following high school, she worked as a clerk at Northwestern Bell Telephone Company, off and on for 30 years, until retiring in 1982. She married Joseph, known as Joe Entz, on October 11, 1951, in Waterloo. He died August 26, 2013. Patty enjoyed singing and listening to music. She and Joe took their family vacations every year following retirement. They traveled to Ireland, England, Germany, and France. They enjoyed attending various Rose Bowls and the Kentucky Derby. They were longtime members of St. Joseph Parish and Queen of Peace Catholic Church. She was a member of the Catholic Daughters of America and Farm Bureau Women. A massive Christian burial for Patricia will be held at 10:30 a.m. Friday, September 23, 2022, at Queen of Peace Catholic Church, with entombment in Mount Olivet Mausoleum Cemetery. Family will greet friends an hour before the services at Queen of Peace Catholic Church. In lieu of flowers, memorials are directed to Cedar Valley Hospice. Locke on 4th Street is assisting the family. Visit www.lockfuneralhome.com to leave condolences. And now let's turn to the opinion section. This opinion piece is a guest essay by Lindsay F. Wiley. Ms. Wiley is a professor of law and the director of health law and policy program at the UCLA School of Law, and it is titled, Extreme Religious Liberty is Undermining Public Health. A federal judge ruled last week that requiring employers to cover PrEP, a medication that helps people at high risk for HIV avoid infection, violates religious liberty because these employers perceive the drug to encourage gay and extramarital sex by making it safer. The ruling suggested extreme skepticism toward the benefits of healthcare regulation. The judge's finding that the government lacked a sufficiently compelling interest to justify requiring health plans to cover preventative health services that stop the spread of HIV indicates disdain for the notion that we're all in this together when it comes to public health. The decision is emblematic of attacks by judges on the legal foundations required for Americans' privatized public health system to function. Because the United States' public health system depends on private corporations, the health of Americans is vulnerable to the whims of vaccine and drug manufacturers, monopolistic insurers, and pharmacy and hospital systems, and employers that share the cost of insurance. Decades of health reforms have attempted to secure the public's interest in universal access to affordable, high-quality health care while maintaining a privatized, fragmented system in the name of individual choice. Bold new attacks on regulation by the judicial branch are threatening this delicate balance. As the legal historian Kate Redburn has persuasively argued, the libertarian wing of the conservative legal movement, by limiting government power, has ensured that private-public partnerships are the only political viable path to secure essential goods and services. Now the religious wing of the movement is using those private-public partnerships to prioritize the moral judgments of a small but politically powerful minority of Americans over the secular civic values endorsed by Democratic majorities. Part of the deal lawmakers struck when they agreed to preserve a central role for private insurance and employee benefits in the Obamacare era is that private companies are now an integral part of our public health system. Healthcare isn't just a personal good. We all benefit from living in a society where our neighbors and coworkers, our kids' classmates, and teachers and others have access to screening and preventive care. This is particularly the case for conditions that are infectious, like COVID and having HIV, and those whose shared burdens grow significantly if they aren't caught and treated early, like diabetes, cancer, heart disease, and depression. The Affordable Care Act recognizes the public benefits of private health coverage by requiring most health plans to cover certain immunizations and preventive services without imposing any out-of-pocket payments that could discourage people from getting the care they need. This is the regulation the Biden administration refers to when it says most people will still be able to get COVID vaccinations free of charge, even after the pandemic response is fully delegated to the private market. We depend on highly regulated and taxpayer-subsidized private companies to secure access to vaccination, viral testing, disease screening, smoking cessation services, contraceptives, counseling, and a whole host of other things vital for the public's health. But the compromise at the heart of the Affordable Care Act isn't working for the public's health. Our dependence on private health care financing leaves us vulnerable to poor health outcomes and shocking inequities. Regulation of what private insurance plans must cover provides a crucial stopgap. But now, under the banner of individual rights, including the rights of for-profit employers, insurers, pharmacies, and hospitals to exercise moral judgment, condemning the use of healthcare services that medical and public health experts deem essential, the courts are eroding the legal foundations for privately financed public health. The opt-outs some judges believe are constitutionally required for anyone who asserts a religious reason for not abiding by generally applicable rules or contributing to collective financing mechanisms are ever expanding. They are also increasingly rooted in animus toward people who exercise their personal autonomy in ways the religious right deems immoral, which the ruling last week underscored. Nearly a decade ago, a similar case worked its way through the courts, resulting in a Supreme Court ruling that at least for some for-profit corporations are entitled to religious exemptions to the contraceptive coverage mandate. Elizabeth Sepper, a constitutional law expert, warned that other demands for religious exemptions would follow, threatening to unravel health care, employment, and civil rights regulations. During the COVID-19 pandemic, the Supreme Court invalidated restrictions that failed to treat religious gatherings with special solicitude, adopting a far more expansive interpretation of what religious freedom requires than held sway in previous decades. Some lower court judges have recently applied the same reasoning to vaccination requirements, ruling that if medical exemptions are allowed, then religious exemptions are constitutionally required. The Supreme Court has, so far, declined to intervene in these disputes, but opponents of routine school vaccination requirements are thrilled by where things seem to be headed. The federal judiciary, transformed by Trump-McConnell appointees, is restriking the balance between public and private interests that undergirds our democratic, capitalistic approach to securing the common good while preserving individual choice. Some judges are also pressing their thumbs on the scale in favor of religious liberty and against other forms of individual autonomy. Securing the public's health requires Americans to work together toward shared goals. The right of individuals and businesses to opt out of doing their part by asserting a religious objection, the legitimacy of which is largely immune from scrutiny, undermines the entire system. Most people may intuitively understand that doing hard things together requires compromise and respect for certain spheres of individual freedom. But few would expect the lines to be where many judges are drawing them now. extreme shifts in longstanding legal doctrines may be designed to target stigmatized groups, people seeking elective abortions, transgender people, and people who are intimate with HIV-positive partners, but the effects will touch everyone. The reasoning in the PREP ruling could be used to invalidate the Affordable Care Act's preventive services coverage mandate in its entirety. Industry experts predict that in the absence of mandates, private employers and insurers will shift even more costs onto patients and their households. Perhaps these assaults will ultimately backfire, bolstering support for public programs that are less dependent on private cooperation. But even if Americans develop a better system, the court rulings holding sway in the meantime will forever alter countless lives by privileging the moral judgments of the few over the essential needs of the many. Next is a guest essay by Alec Wilkinson, and he has titled it, Math is the Great Secret. As a boy in the first weeks of algebra class, I felt confused and then I went sort of numb. Adolescence ordered the world from fragments of information. In its way, adolescence is a kind of algebra. The unknowns can be determined, but doing so requires a special aptitude, not to mention a comfort with having things withheld. Straightforward, logical thinking is required, and a willingness to follow rules which aren't evenly distributed adolescent capabilities. When I thought about mathematics at all as a boy, it was to speculate about why I was being made to learn it, since it seemed plainly obvious that there was no need for it in adult life. Balancing a checkbook or drawing up a budget was the answer we were given for how math would prove necessary later. But you don't need algebra or geometry or calculus to do either of those things. But if I had understood how deeply mathematics is embedded in the world, how it figures in every gesture we make, whether crossing a crowded street or catching a ball, how it figures in painting and perspective, and in architecture, and in the natural world, and so on, then perhaps I might have seen it the way the ancients had seen it, as a fundamental part of the world's design, perhaps even the design itself. If I had felt that the world was connected in its parts, I might have been provoked to a kind of wonder and enthusiasm I might have wanted to learn. 5 years ago, when I was 65, I decided to see if I could learn adolescent mathematics, algebra, geometry, and calculus. Because I had done poorly at algebra and geometry, and I hadn't taken calculus at all, I didn't do well at it the second time either. But I have become a kind of math evangelist. Mathematics, I now see, is important because it expands the world. It is a point of entry into larger concerns. It teaches reverence. It insists one be receptive to wonder. It requires that a person pay close attention. To be made to consider a problem carefully discourages scattershot and slovenly thinking and encourages systematic thought, an advantage, so far as I can tell, in all endeavors. Abraham Lincoln said he spent a year reading Euclid in order to learn to think logically. Studying adolescent mathematics, a person is crossing territory on which footprints have been left since antiquity. Some of the trails have been made by distinguished figures, but the bulk of them have been left by ordinary people like me. As a boy, trying to follow a path in a failing light, I never saw the mysteries I was moving along. But on my second pass, I began to. Nothing had changed about math, but I had changed. The person I had become was someone whom I couldn't have imagined as an adolescent. Math was different because I was different. The beginner math mystery, available to anyone, concerns the origin of numbers. It's a simple speculation. Where do numbers come from? No one knows. Were they invented by human beings? Hard to say. They appear to be embedded in the world in ways that we can't completely comprehend. They began as measurements of quantities and grew into the means for the most precise expressions of the physical world. For example, E equals mc squared. The second mystery is that of prime numbers. Those numbers such as 2, 3, 5, 7, 11, and 13 that can't be divided evenly only by one or by themselves. All numbers not prime are called composite numbers, and all composite numbers are the result of a unique arrangement of primes. 2 times 2 equals 4, 2 times 3 equals 6, 2 times 2 times 2 equals 8, 3 times 3 equals 9, 2 times 3 times 3 times 37 equals 666, and so on. If human beings invented numbers and counting, then how is it that there are numbers such as primes that have attributes no one gave them? The grand and the unfolding mystery is whether mathematics is created by human beings or exists independently of us in a territory adjacent to the actual world, the location of which no one can specify. Plato called it the non-spatio-temporal realm. It is the timeless nowhere that never has and never will exist anywhere, but that nevertheless is. Mathematics is one of the most efficient means of approaching the great secret of considering what lies past all that we can see or presently imagine. Mathematics doesn't describe the secret so much as it implies that there is one. On my second engagement, whenever I encountered a definition of mathematics, I wrote it down. Among those I liked best was that mathematics is a story that has been written for thousands of years, is always being added to, and might never be finished. Such a thought would have appealed to me deeply as a boy. It might have made mathematics seem maybe not welcoming, but at least less forbidding than it appeared. And listeners, that's going to do it for today's reading of the Waterloo Cedar Falls Courier for Wednesday, September 21st. I'm your volunteer reader, Bob Young. You can access a recording of today's reading on our website, iowaradioreading.org, at any time. And we want to thank you for listening to Your Iris, Iowa's first and only radio reading service.